to www.integralnaked.org.
Ken, how fascinating this conversation is, in that almost every question I had in my mind, you came up with the answer. I was like, how does he know that? And interesting, the question that I have, I was thinking that it might not flow, but it flows just out of that last piece that you were just talking about, I think, anyway.
Right.
So in our course of study, we were taking apart the AQOL, and we explored types. Right. And so what we were asked to do was explore how did we see ourselves individually as either masculine or feminine.
Yeah.
And how fascinating it was to see all the postings, because a lot of people mentioned that as they were, you know, growing and developing, that they were seeing a commingling and an incorporating of these traits as people grew and developed.
Yeah.
And I posted a question to Randy, and I said, gee whiz, do these belong on the lines of development? Is this one of the 12 or others?
Right.
Because as people are growing and developing, they're becoming one. They're getting hold of this. And so I was kind of curious about your thoughts about that.
Yeah. Depending on how you define gender growth, I think it is a distinct line of development. And one of the ones, I want to get the terminology exactly right, so I'm going to flip here to the charts in the back of Integral Psychology. And it actually has the line on gender, and I've taken it into second and third levels. Let me find that. And I'll just briefly read you what I had here, which morphological genetic givens, this is from the lowest to the highest, undifferentiated basic gender identity, gender conventionality, gender consistency and norms, gender androgyny, transdifferentiated, and then tantric union and beyond gender. So that's just extremely loose and crude beginning, but what we do see is that gender identity as a line generally considered to be one. And of course, Kohlberg wrote about that, and Gilligan and so on. What they all do tend to find is that just that. It starts out and your gender is close to your sex.
Mm-hmm.
And sex usually is defined as biological aspects, and gender is cultural or psychological. And so generally people at lower levels of development, red for example, are very, very macho. And if their masculinity is threatened, they will kill you. They're homophobic. I mean, God bless them. It's not that there's a choice here. And then as you move into amber, those gender differences tend to be cemented as God's way. And so it's very, very difficult for somebody in amber, very difficult for a woman to be a feminist and a believer in traditional values. They just pretty much don't mix. But once you break out of that absolutistic level of cognitive perception, you know, let me preface that by saying, and what that means is that even though you're in a biological body that's sending up estrogen signals or sending up testosterone signals and so on, that's only in the upper right quadrant. And that's not the other three quadrants. And one of the reasons that feminists get very upset when you talk about biological differences is just what we were saying earlier. Any difference you name will be used as a ranking. We would add by people at lower levels of development. But one of the ways liberals tried to stop that is to get rid of all ranking entirely. There are no gender differences between men and women. They're all cultural. And they thought that would stop oppression. It's a good idea, but no, it doesn't work because it's really not a good idea. But you can see why they would try to do that. But what we say, what an integral feminist says, is, well, we can talk about biological differences. Good Lord, they're there, and they're real, and they are universals. And that doesn't mean that a person is, well, you can span a whole spectrum of those universals, though, so that's not to pigeonhole somebody. Janet Chaffetz does a wonderful job of acknowledging those universal biological givens, but then she says there are social systems that modify those. Now, for her, that's the lower right quadrant, and I think she's a genius. She's my single favorite feminist writer anywhere, and she's working with the upper right and the lower right. And I agree with pretty much everything she said, but I think she's fantastic. But we add the upper left and lower left also. So we say, well, social systems are modified by cultural systems. And I can modify a cultural system by my own upper left awareness. So we use all four quadrants, and we're not afraid of universals in any one quadrant because we've got the other three to outdo them. And so it's a much, much better way to deal with feminist issues than to try to simply deny differences between men and women, which gets you nowhere. But what that means, back to our story, is that if you're at an amber altitude, mythic membership, blue beaming, it's a very conformist structure and very absolutistic. And that's important at that level. That's a big step up from RAD, incidentally. We have to keep this in context. It's an extraordinary leap forward, absolutely amazing. And it's how the real, real harsh edges of RAD are hammered down. And we sometimes look back and say, well, you cut off a man's hand because he stole something, and we're just horrified. But for amber, that actually, it's a long story, but it's a good idea in particular contexts. But it does mean that if you have any impulses in your body that, let's say you're born homosexual, and that does mean that if you're a male, you are biologically going to be predisposed to be attracted to other males. It's not a choice. So you're at amber, and your body is telling you that you like men. Your culture is telling you that you're going to burn in hell forever. And most likely, you're going to believe that. You've internalized it in your upper left. And that's just horrible. But again, you have these things have to be looked at on the, you know, on the big view, and that's the price you pay for getting the stability that amber brings to a red world, a brutally red world, red in tooth and claw. But what the great thing is that now you start to move into orange. Now you move into universal structures. The first thing you do at orange is you disbelieve all of the stuff you got at amber. You question traditional values. You do not believe the Bible is literally true. All of a sudden now you're in a space where your body's impulses can be heard, whatever they are. And so your upper left quadrant starts to have a freedom that it never had before. And that's what's so great about orange. I mean, it's the single greatest structure that the world has seen to date. And then green increased that freedom. In each of those cases, what you're doing is moving farther away from nature, nature with a small n. And the farther you get away from that, the farther you get away from biological givens, and the less your gender is determined by your sex. And what that really means is it starts to, studies kind of continually show, that you get less and less stereotypical and more androgynous. Now, a lot of people get confused here because they think androgynous means sort of, you know, namby-pamby, anemic sexuality. I mean, how, you know, how masculinely aggressive can you be if you're, you know, an androgyn? But what actually can happen is that males can get more aggressively masculine in a certain sense, precisely because they've transcended it, precisely because they are no longer embedded in their male sexuality. They can really step on the gas pedal, and sometimes they become more comfortable in their masculinity and can express it more, precisely because they're no longer embedded in it or afraid of it or terrified and so on. So to say that you're more androgynous or you're transcending gender doesn't mean that you become kind of washed out and pale and anemic. That tends to happen in green, incidentally, and that's where David Data is green's savior when it comes to sexuality. But you do tend to, in that sense, become even transgender, because when you get into third tier, your identity isn't really even bodily oriented. It's not even oriented towards the personal organism. It's fully anchored in it. But you're basically constantly, your sense of identity is literally everything, everything that's arising moment to moment. And your body is a texture of that one thing, that one taste, that's the only thing that is moment to moment. And so you're not on this side of your face looking at the world out there. There is just out there. There's just this. And it's not out there and it's not in here. And so that just drops away. And my favorite phrase for that, which I couldn't understand it at all, was when Trungpa said, the sky turns into a big blue pancake and falls on your head. And all he meant by that is there's no separation between you and the sky. You can taste the sky. It's like a pancake right where your head was. And so gender at that point is just not an issue even. But then when you, in your relative self, not your absolute self, in your relative self, you're interacting as we are interacting. And so there you're an embodied person. And instantly getting disembodied is the ultimate step. I'm a pet peeve of embodied cognition. So I can puke next time I hear that. But it's important to get embodied. And it's more important to be trans-embodied and transgendered, although that has a different meaning. So that's kind of the story of sex and gender, is starting where gender's embedded in sex. then gender and sex are differentiated enough that you can start to transcend sex, and then you transcend gender. And that's kind of first, second, and third tier. It's a really good, pretty good summary. First tier is sex, and second tier is gender, and third tier is transgender. So that's just a riff on it. I mean, that's sort of what I'm doing on this, just kind of rambling, if that's okay.
Thank you very much.
Does it make sense to you?
Yes, it does, yeah. I'm smiling.
Okay, great.
You are listening to www.integralnakedhair.com.